Hello and welcome everyone back to another episode of The Publisher Lab. I am Tyler Bishop and joined alongside me today is The Machines. And I, for one, welcome our new robot overlords. For those that are just listening and not following along on YouTube or any of the other video platforms that you would watch our podcast on, we have the T-600 Terminator here, which was actually a acquisition of mine whenever we first moved into the offices over here. And I have slowly but surely wrestled it away to my side of the office. And today, since you're going to get a relatively solo episode with just me talking, I know it seems like a lot, I figured I'd put the machines here in the chair next to me and, you know, give it that ominous feel that it feels like the environment sort of has right now with everything that has emerged with AI and really a lot of different things in terms of emerging tech. And my producer, Manny, here should help me out a little bit. He'll keep me from straying too far off the beaten path. And Manny's spent a lot of time behind the scenes. But Manny, how does it feel to be the only one alone with me and the machine here in the studio?
I don't really like how the Terminator is looking at me, but I'm really glad to be on the podcast on this side of the audio for the first time.
Yeah, Manny is multifaceted in his talents. He is both, which a term that I feel like has been used in media for a long time that apparently nobody else inside of the office uses is pot. Like, you pot somebody up to like turn up the volume on a mixing board. I always tell Manny that he should pot this up or pot that down, and I know that he just thinks I'm making it up. But somebody out there, podcast listeners, if you've ever heard that before, I would love any other confirmation, because I've yet to find any. So
when you first said that, I immediately thought of Dr. Dre and Eminem. It's like, turn me up in the headphones, please.
Yeah, I feel like if they just would have like referenced pop me up, I need you to pot up my snare and my headphones or something like that, I'd have a little bit more validation. But nevertheless, I do feel like we've gotten to this point now where everything is somewhat AI related as it relates to topical news in our space. But there are things that I think are interconnected. And I think the fundamentals of digital publishing really haven't changed all that much in terms of the interest that publishers have. And that's a good portion of what we're going to navigate today. And I think all across sides of the spectrum. So without any further ado, the first story that we had that caught our attention today was one from Adweek, and the headline was, "Ad Buyers Redirect YouTube Strategies After Report That Accuses It of Violating Standards." So ad buyers are adjusting their YouTube strategies following a report that accuses the platform of violating standards. This is something that's happened before, surprisingly. Oh my gosh, everyone is in shock. The report claims that YouTube's algorithm recommended harmful and inappropriate content to users, including minors. It would be almost impossible not to include minors with a platform like YouTube. Advertisers are concerned about their brand safety and reputation when their ads appear alongside questionable content. This is an old one, you know, like this is goes back as far as the start of time. Advertisers are concerned about brand safety on the internet. Go figure. And some advertisers shifting their ad spend away from YouTube and reallocating it to alternative platforms. And brands are demanding more transparency and stricter content moderation measures from YouTube. Advertisers are exploring options such as whitelisting trusted channels or using third-party verification tools to mitigate these risks. YouTube is taking steps to reevaluate their targeting and content guidelines to ensure their ads are shown in suitable context. And or that's what advertisers are doing, and YouTube is taking steps to address concerns, including updating its policies and increasing manual content reviews. So I think the biggest thing with something like this, and Manny, I don't know, going back, do you remember from 5 or 6 years ago, do you remember there being like a kind of a big hubbub? Is this something that ever hit mainstream about like brands pulling all their ads, like P&G and some of those other ones pulling their ad spend off YouTube?
I do recall that. I remember a few years ago when a lot of advertisers were pulling stuff off because they didn't know what kind of channels they were having their ads run in front of.
Yeah, exactly.
Especially in international countries where the language, you know, they were maybe talking about all sorts of outlandish stuff, but the YouTube, you know, algorithm couldn't catch any of that bad stuff that they were showing.
Yeah, I think there was one incident in particular that happened in the UK where they used the term extremist content now, but there was a literal beheading video that advertisers were having their ads shown next to, and a lot of people screen capped it. And it was kind of a big PR nightmare for those advertisers, and that's what led to kind of a protest. And I think that you start to see this over and over again inside of the media space. And it has very little to do with actual brand safety. It has to do, I think, a lot more with negotiation power. So what happens is, you know, as more and more of your digital budget shifts towards these platforms from an advertiser perspective, you see it as more and more of a risk. Like, companies across the world, especially tech companies, are cutting costs and trying to figure out how do you adapt to an environment with changing interest rates. And so you look at your advertising spending, marketing budgets are usually the first ones that either get cut or, you know, you try to figure out how you optimize that spend. And you look at it and you go, well, we're spending a good portion of our digital advertising, which is the majority of our advertising budget now, on, you know, YouTube or Google, or, I mean, just really give it the blanket statement of Google search, display, and video. And so then you go, well, how can I get a better value for that? And I think one of the things that everybody recognizes in advertising that there is waste, and we've talked about this before on the show. So I see this as just more performative. It's the top end of advertisers trying to negotiate with YouTube on essentially what controls and sort of like what kind of rates they can get. They're trying to establish new mechanisms or back channels where they can get private marketplaces or private deals. They just want more features, or they want more flexibility in terms of, you know, revenue share and stuff like that they can get directly through the platform, because they can't just directly sell, you know, like ad space and implement it programmatically on a YouTube channel. That's something they could do if they own their own video. And it's something that I recommend that all publishers do. There's no downside in, you know, if you put a video on YouTube, you should definitely host it someplace yourself on a website or someplace where you have full control over, you know, how you can monetize, collect audience, you know, connections and things like that. To me, it's a no-brainer. And I think if we look and project out into the future, I think one of the things that we will see is that YouTube will start to lose a little bit of its dominance here. And you've seen this a little bit with ad platforms popping up, like for places that are like sellers of goods. Amazon was obviously the first to do this, but saw Kroger released their own sort of like ad buying platform now. So you can buy like, you know, like ad space on Kroger's website. You can buy it in like their, I guess the weekly that goes out to everybody with their, you know, like they still send the grocery things out each week, right, Manny, with the promotions where you can get like milk like cheaper or whatever.
Yeah, those are like the weekly deals. I was thinking if we can get an Azoic ad in the condiment section.
Yeah, I think it makes total sense that, I mean, it's so strange to me, this idea of programmatic buying on print, but it makes total sense. And I don't think that that's the primary objective of Kroger's initiative. But you're seeing this in a lot of things where it's like, you know, Netflix has an ad funded model now. You have people like the Trade Desk who are building lots and lots of deals across, you know, like smaller and smaller inventories of video. And so I think what you're seeing is sort of like, you know, I always say that the universe is always in a state of bundling or unbundling. And we're in an unbundling state right now, where I think you're going to see, you know, it's good and bad for publishers from the standpoint of like, you're going to have to put your video or own your video or find partners and things like that, that are, you know, able to help you sort of like maximize your reach and like the revenue that you can extract from your content. Because it's going to be more splintered than maybe it's been in the past. And, you know, that means more opportunity and usually like greater upside, but, you know, it's a lot more to navigate and usually increased complexity. So, and speaking of increased complexity, I think, Manny, you were actually the one yesterday that turned me on to this, that Elon Musk is unveiling a new startup, an AI startup called XAI, and it's a little X and then a big AI. How did this come across your, where did you see this? How did you see this before I did?
So this was reported from Axios.com, and Elon Musk has found some more time to work on a new startup company since Twitter is basically running itself right now. he wanted to focus his company on AI that's more explainable and more transparent. He was concerned about the understanding of how AI arrives to conclusions and the ability to interrogate its reasoning. He warned against the, everybody just blindly accepting AI outputs without proper scrutiny and oversight. So I think he's more concerned about transparency than anything else when it comes to this new AI revolution.
And, you know, I think I thought about this a lot because I was telling you afterwards, I was like, well, if we want AI to explain what it was thinking, you know, I don't know that you're going to get a better answer than what a person is thinking. Either you're going to have really crappy AI that's like not able to, you know, provide much value, I think, in a future world where AI has improved significantly, or you're going to be basically just kind of making it up. And I thought more about this, and I'll explain this a little bit more for those that are maybe like, what does he mean? So I explained this, I think, in the previous podcast about how machine learning works and it's comparing it to neurons. But one of the things that's interesting is, you know, if you think about why is it that, you know, if you go to a store, you see a shirt and you're like, I like that shirt. Why? Why do you like that one? Well, maybe it's trendy. Maybe you like that color. Maybe you like the way that it maybe fits you personally. There could be a lot of reasons. You might not be able to point to one specifically. In fact, you could probably make some kind of emotional connection to it as well and go all the way back to your childhood if you wanted to. So you think about all the little different factors that go into why you might like something versus not. And so to explain that to somebody would be almost impossible because you have to take into like the complexity of the human experience. And I think that that exists with AI as well. It's why an AI can't, you know, print out a report and be like, I made this decision because of this, this, and this. It's all these sort of tiny learning, you know, mechanisms. They call it like deep learning and quote unquote large language models. These things are big. It's lots and lots of reinforcement or data over time that it collects, and those things act like neurons where it's not one specific thing that is determining why you would make a decision unless it's a very simplified AI model. So with very targeted and specific models, you could definitely print out something that says like, you know, this is weighted on X, Y, and Z, and it's why it made this decision. But you're gonna have a really hard time getting a machine to tell you why it made a decision in the same way that it's going to be hard to find out for sure why a human made a decision. Now, you can get some context and maybe you can get a human and a machine to explain itself. But then it really comes back to credibility. And this is what I was thinking about yesterday, Manny, after we had this discussion, was that the credibility, I think, that is, you know, exists with human beings. Like, you know, if some guy off the street tells me that, tells me how to handle a medical condition, and then a doctor in a doctor's office tells me how to handle it, I'm going to probably lend a little bit more credence to the doctor in the doctor's office because I know that they have the training. The guy off the street that's just, you know, maybe seems like a crazy person or something like that. Bad example. You guys know me and examples on this show. I think that you look at something like that and you go, well, I don't know what his background is. Doesn't strike me as overly credible. So maybe I can't put as much weight into, you know, the sort of output that I would get from that versus the other. And so this is where I kind of look at something like this and I go, well, there is potential here if you can have sort of an objective evaluation of how good the quality of the models are for certain types of decisions. And I think that, you know, kind of reading a little bit more about it, it's really hard to tell if that's what it's going to be. There's a lot of buzzwords and then sort of like the marketing sort of slogans, which is like, you know, AI needs to be held accountable. The algorithms, you know, could be biased or incorrect. And it's like, these are like almost like, you know, polarizing political statements where it's like, you know, somebody can say like, you know, I think that, you know, the taxes are too high, you know, and I think that, you know, we need more jobs and we want more teachers and we need more, you know, we want to have a better justice system. It's like, yeah, everybody wants those things, you know? So it's hard to say that those things are unwanted, and that's not the goal of pretty much everything that's, you know, working inside of those respective spheres. So it'll be interesting to see what if anything comes of that. Elon has a habit of kind of announcing a lot of like bigger ideas, and then, I mean, a lot of them end up do coming to fruition, but we'll see what happens with this one.
I'm still holding out for Neuralink.
Yeah, and you know, he's been big on the Terminators here too. You know, hopefully we can make the one that's sitting next to me today a real life one at some point. Because have you seen his the Tesla humanoid robots?
Yeah, I've seen them.
Yeah, they're really creepy. I don't know why we would. I mean, that just seems like, you know, it's taunting. It's like so much hubris in making it a human one. It's like we have the Terminator movies. It's what everybody's afraid of. Like, just make them dogs or something. You know, anything else.
I've seen that episode of Black Mirror. Dogs don't help either.
Yeah, not dogs. Maybe just like, I don't know. What's an animal that you would be less afraid of if it was a robot?
A manta ray.
That's
flat.
That's a terrible idea.
I'm not afraid of my.
I'd imagine they would fly. They get out of sight of the ocean. I'm thinking more like a koala bear or something like that. You know.
Yeah, just don't port over any of the audio that koalas actually make, because they sound terrifying.
Yeah. Koalas are actually quite terrifying. And speaking of quite terrifying, beautiful transition. I'm pretty good at this stuff. Google's search ranking algorithm was something that got a lot of attention over the weekend. I've talked a lot about this sort of subject in the past, and you guys will get a diatribe from me today on it. But I know that it is something that's caught the attention of a lot of our audience and publishers, which is there was a lot of volatility this weekend. SEO Roundtable, our good friend Barry Schwartz, has basically said that, you know, he put in one of the headlines, is it ranking tools? So Google search ranking algorithm experienced a period of volatility and fluctuations. The volatility that they're referring to is referenced by or measured in reference by multiple tools that are out there. There's several SEO tool companies that produce free sort of like volatility measurement devices that are out there. I'm sure our audience is overly familiar with them. Webmasters and SEO professionals observed also significant shifts in search rankings and organic traffic. You know, that's objective data, I suppose, but it's not that objective in that it's a very small sample. So I would always say take sort of that experience with a grain of salt, but some websites experienced notable gains or losses in visibility and rankings. The update appears to have affected a wide range of industries and search queries, which that doesn't appear anything. There's nobody that knows that. Google did not provide specific details or confirm the update. Algorithm updates are a regular occurrence. Google constantly refines them and its ranking algorithm. Webmasters and SEO professionals should monitor their websites' performance and adapt their strategies accordingly. The volatility in search rankings made it difficult for these tools to provide accurate and consistent data. According to the SEO Roundtable article, and fluctuations in rankings could be attributed to algorithm updates, changes in user behavior, or other factors. Webmasters and SEO professionals faced challenges in assessing the impact of these changes because of the lack of visibility, because of the impact of the changes and the volatility and the inability for anybody in this entire space to measure anything related to it. And I think that that's the issue with most of these types of articles, is that, you know, whenever I see something, especially when it's not confirmed by Google, I kind of go back to, and this is things that I've shared on this podcast before, having been in that building and spent a lot of time with the teams there and worked in the space for nearly two decades, I can tell you a couple things, one of which is that anything that's massively disruptive to the search results is viewed as viewed very negatively inside of Google. It means that their product lacks consistency and that usually users are very unhappy with that. So they typically, if they make a change or they do something that is fairly volatile to and recognized by all publishers, They view that as a pretty negative thing. You can think back to like the early Hummingbird and Panda updates. You'll also probably remember, if you're a Google aficionado, that Larry Page actually came back and took back the CEO position right around that same time. And a big reason is because the volatility experienced through sort of those updates and the changes. You can remember Google Plus was like going in, the search page was getting all kinds of new widgets and stuff added to it. They saw that as sort of like they were ruining the product. And so the product has been incredibly consistent for the longest period of time. If you look at the Google.com landing page, it's been the same since 2002. It almost is like hardly any different. And they take that same philosophy throughout their entire product. And so Google search ranking, quote unquote, algorithm is largely unchanged in 20 years. And so I think the industry and sort of like entire ethos built around sort of like the knowledge or the secrets for SEO are very much overblown in many ways. And I do think that whenever you start seeing things like, oh, the volatility indexes are breaking and things like that, which you're more likely seeing other than actual changes in rankings, are changes in the SERP itself. And I think that these actually play a much more dramatic role and for publishers, and should be a more concerning one for them. So if you think about it, you go to, you search something, the search results page, what do you get? You know, you used to not get videos at the top. Now you might get a series of videos as the first results. You may get People Also Ask, you may get a news carousel, you may get a product carousel, and you get any number of other rich results. Like you might just get the answer in a knowledge graph or something like that. And I think one of the things that we've noticed more and more here recently is that you can keep the same ranking position, but the other material on the search results page, the SERP is often called, those things cannibalize the attention of the searcher as much as anything. And that's the core thing that Google is typically measuring, is what is the relationship between the user and the search results page? Like, are they getting what they need? Do they go to a page? Do they come back? Do they search something different and similar right afterwards? Do you give them a knowledge graph answer and do they just leave? Like, is that good or is that bad? Probably sometimes for some things, yes, it's good. For other things, it's bad. I think it's probably not a great idea to try to make guesses on that sort of thing if you're a publisher, because you just have no data. You'll never know if you're right or wrong. But the one thing that I think is worth monitoring is basically, you know, your own Search Console data. See, whenever you are seeing, you know, fluctuations that are outside of seasonality, is it your ranking position that's changed for your queries and your pages? If it is, that could be something where it's like, it could be your content. There could be some kind of change where it's like, go look at what other content is ranking. Maybe it's video oriented. Maybe, you know, written content for the specific query is something that's like becoming less and less important. And maybe it's more video content. If it's something that is, the rankings are staying the same, but you're seeing less overall traffic, seeing the same number of impressions, but fewer clicks, that means that there's something else on that page that's cannibalizing the attention. Could be, you know, a rich result. See if you can get that one for your page so that it's something that, you know, you're able to capitalize on. And if it's not, if it's, you know, something that is maybe more permanent than that, then you may want to look at just the overall sort of like category of that query of content, because it's possible that Google will, you know, slowly but surely eat away at that one. And you don't want to make more content, no matter how popular it is, of something that like isn't going to get found in search if that's your strategy. Now, I would argue that every point of this should emphasize to publishers just how overly dependent that they are on Google search. But it's also the number one traffic driver for most websites across the internet. So I understand that. But I think one of the things that we're going to have to do is adapt quickly to changing, environments. I think that we're going to see, sort of in the same way we were talking about earlier on, the splintering of, you know, where advertisers put their dollars. They might not just dump it all into Google here in the near future. In the same way that I don't think Google is going to send all websites the majority of the traffic in the near future as well. I think you're going to have to find ways to both market and find platforms and outlets where, you know, your audiences are at, that you can create content that is, you know, sort of passively marketed. SEO is great because people think of it as passive marketing, but in many ways, it's renting an audience from Google. And I think that that's something that is a broader thing that most sites should look at, is like, what makes your content not a commodity? And it should be you. Whatever it is you as the publisher have, or the resources that you have that help you, you know, produce your website or blog. But yeah, I think that's sort of my take on SEO in general. And it's something that I've talked about in previous episodes. So if you want to go deeper and you want to hear me talk and rail about all things Google, you're spoiled for choice. And going back and looking at the archive, Manny, you've had to hear it many, many times. Did I leave out any important details of my rants from the past?
No. This is not the first time you talk about SEO. So if you go to any of our past episodes, you can definitely, you know, do a deep dive of all of Tyler's previous mentions of everything SEO and all the concerns with it.
And what's our website, Manny, before I mess it up?
Oh, yes. You can find all of our past episodes and any new information at thepublisherlab.org. You can leave any suggestions for the podcast. I promise you we read all of them and we listen to everyone's suggestions. Tyler, before we head out, make sure that we do our Nike check of the week.
So I've got some Air Maxes on here today. I don't know if I've had these ones before on the podcast. I try to pick what I'm going to wear based on what shoes I don't think that I've had on when I've been on the podcast now. So whoever is driving the interest in the sneakers, like, you're keeping me on my toes and you're convincing, you're helping me try to convince my wife that I need to buy more shoes, which you would think she would just be totally on board with. But every single time I feel like I've got to just like be like, nope, you know, it's for work, you know? Obviously.
It's for work.
So I want to thank everybody for listening. You can always find us on any of the podcast platforms, you know, the big ones. And you can actually watch the show on YouTube if you want to come and check out the Terminator that's sitting next to me. And yeah, like Manny mentioned before, if you have comments or questions, those are great. They really help us just kind of guide and direct the show directly towards you, the audience, and what you want to hear about. And it's been another episode of the Publisher Lab. And thanks everybody for joining and listening or watching.